Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show, friends, this week. Happy to have you here, as always, of course. And hey, if you're listening here on the radio on Friday, February 12th, I'm going to say something I haven't had a chance to say yet. Happy Carnival. Yeah, let that sink in. It's a little bit weird, isn't it? No, it's a lot weird. And, you know, I always like Mardi Gras because it's weird, or often many parts of it are weird, but in a good way. This is not necessarily weird in a good way, but it is what it is. And hey, we're all doing our best to do the right thing. I hope that's what I want to encourage everybody to do out there is do the right thing. Don't be a jerk. Be a good community member. Be a good citizen, good family member, good friend. Social distancing. Wear a mask. Don't go do something stupid. Okay. I know the temptation is there. The desire is there. I'm right there with you. I absolutely feel it. Pining for Mardi Gras, just like everybody else out there is here in the New Orleans area. But, you know, if we don't do what we're supposed to do, it's just going to take us that much longer to get back to normal or whatever new normal will be. And, you know, we want to make sure that we have a proper Mardi Gras in 2022, right? So, you know, if you're here in New Orleans, we know the big chunks of the French Quarter are going to be closed. There's a curfew. There's no go drinks. So just don't do stupid stuff. Now, what I do want to encourage you to do, aside from being responsible and not being a jerk, is I want to encourage you, if you can, and you're comfortable with it, you know, go support some of the local restaurants that are actually open through this, especially the ones that are handling things the way they're supposed to. They need our business. This is certainly a time, of course, as we all know here, and if you're not here, you know, if you're listening to the podcast from afar, you can probably imagine, people make money. Hospitality industry makes money over Mardi Gras, and it's yet another event that has robbed the hospitality industry of a lot of its economic viability, and they're hurting, and we know this. I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know. But if you can, go out, get some go food, go dine out somewhere where I know the weather's going to be kind of stinky, but you know, somewhere where they're doing it right, and support local business. That's the one thing I would encourage you to do, and just do it responsibly. And again, please just don't be a jerk. Okay, it's not that hard. It's really not that hard. We'll get through it, and we'll be back to whatever our new normal is, as I just said, sooner than later, if everybody pulls together and does what they're supposed to do. And looking forward to Mardi Gras 2022, friends. Got a really good show coming up for you here this week. Oh, quick programming note. In an effort to seek a sense of normalcy, we will be taking our short Mardi Gras break next week, and we'll be back with some new shows after that. We're going to have some really good stuff coming up for you, so stay tuned for information on new episodes. But this particular episode, I'm very excited about. We're going to be, because we recorded the feature interviews we usually do beforehand. We were at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum there on O.C. Haley Boulevard in Central City. And this show, as you've heard me talk about a lot already, probably, is part of the podcast network over there at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum called the Nitty Grits Podcast Network. Go to southernfood.org. You'll find it there. But what we're talking about today, we're joined by the museum's founder, Liz Williams. We've never really done a show talking about the history of the museum and talk in depth to a degree anyway about the programs that they have there, how you can connect with the museum. They are open. They are doing things the right way. So go pay them a visit. We talk about the hours and how you can do all that good stuff. It's a really fascinating museum, and how you can also connect with the museum online through things like the Nitty Grits Podcast Network and other things. They do cooking demos online and all kinds of cool stuff like that. So we're going to kind of get the whole story of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum from the proper source, right? Liz Williams, who founded the museum. It's a really interesting interview. And it's fun to chat with her. She does a podcast on the network there as well called Tip of the Tongue. It's an excellent show. Excuse me. Go check that out. So a really fun interview there, friends. And we're going to bounce right over to the Southern Food and Beverage Museum after we take a short break. And talking about SOFAB, because that's what they call the museum, right? We're cool. We're quick. We do acronyms here on the NOLA Drink Show because we're that busy. No, we're not. But we're going to be over at SOFAB chatting with Liz Williams and getting the scoop over there, friends. Take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
We're sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm going to set your flag on fire. Talking about him.
Brought to you by the St. Rock Market, a local food hall featuring 12 unique food and beverage entrepreneurs serving globally inspired meals from barbecue platters to Mediterranean cuisine. Located at 2381 St. Claude Avenue, the St. Rock Market is open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, dinner, coffee, and cocktails. We offer online ordering, curbside pickup, and both indoor and patio dining. Learn more at strockmarket.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. Happy to have you here. As always, we are here, as you know, at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, one of my very favorite places to be. It's one of the only places, actually, that I go to now outside of my own home or the grocery store these days. Here a lot, it seems, which is great. And we're chatting with the founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, Liz Williams, who is also a podcast network mate of mine as well. Liz, how are you?
I'm doing really well.
It's good to see you.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And so people have been hearing this on my show because I keep, you know, mentioning it, and it's out there in the world. But we all have our shows collectively, you and I. And
that's right.
On the Nitty Grits Podcast Network, which is part of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum media thing.
That's now. Right. Yes. And it's really kind of exciting. We have some new ones coming up mm-hmm. soon, and we are hoping to continue to expand the Nitty Grits Network.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it because it's such a cool thing. And we've talked about it on the Nitty Grits Roundup show. You can go to southernfood.org, friends, and look right there at the top. You'll see a media tab. Click on that. There's the podcast network. And we're doing a monthly roundup show, which we've just started doing. So it's been you and I and Brent who's the yes. president of the museum here, and letting people know that you can go connect with all these shows. But yeah, and I keep promising people we're going to have new shows. And not just here in New Orleans. I mean, it's people from all over the place.
That's right. That's right. The one that I think we'll see first is the one that Ashbel McElveen will be doing called Ghost in the Kitchen. And it's going to be about people who basically have not come to light, but who've had a lot of influence on the food of America,
mm-hmm.
mostly black and brown people.
Right. And that's cool because he it's part of the Hemmings Project, right? Is that what
the
official title?
So he is the founder of the James Hemmings Society.
Society, right.
Okay. And James Hemmings was President Jefferson's cook.
Mm-hmm.
And went with him together to learn how to cook and train in the fine restaurants of Paris,
mm-hmm.
and came back with Jefferson and ultimately was freed by Jefferson.
Right. Cool. We're looking forward to that show being on. He's out of Baltimore. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, cool. So, friends, stay tuned for that. Go catch the Roundup show. This would probably be stuff I'd say at the end of the show, but we'll revisit. Go catch the Roundup show. But, Liz, I was saying, we were talking about this before when we were setting this show up. I've taped a lot of shows here over the past couple years, and especially a lot lately, and you've got your great show, Tip of the Tongue, which we'll talk about. But we've never actually done, on my show, we've never done a show about the museum itself. We've kind of dabbled in it here and there and mentioned it, but we've never really told the story of the museum on this program. So that's kind of what I wanted to get with you about today because, well, you were there from day one. I think you were the museum founder, weren't you?
Yes.
So you seem like the proper source for the story. I mean, might as well just cut to the chase, right, and go to you. So tell us a little bit, Liz, about how and when did the museum get started?
So it's one of those evolutions, obviously. We started in 2004 with the concept, creating the corporation, getting nonprofit status, all of those things that you do.
All the fun paperwork.
Right. And we were actually in talks about finding a location and whatever. And then in 2005, Hurricane Katrina happened. Now, before Hurricane Katrina happened, we had two pop-up exhibits. We had one in the New Orleans Center, which is the former mall right there by the Superdome.
Mm-hmm.
And that one was called Toast of New Orleans. And it was all about things to drink in New Orleans, everything from coffee and chicory and nectar soda to the Sazerac and absinthe and all of that. And that was number one. And then we had a second pop-up that happened in early 2005 that was all through the linear public space of the Riverwalk.
Oh,
and okay. That one was called Toot Sweet, all about sugar. And that one, of course, got totally trashed during Hurricane Katrina. Mm. But we decided that when we talked to people about starting a food museum, they couldn't understand what the concept was. And we were trying to sell it, obviously, before it began. And so we had to give people a taste of what it was. And so that's what the pop-ups were for. Obviously, this was before the word pop-up was in popular use. So we were calling it things like this is an exhibit in a borrowed public space, things like
that. Yeah, that's pretty wordy, huh? Let's just go by again.
Yeah. So now I can say pop-up and people actually know what that means, but they absolutely didn't know what it would mean in the beginning. But it did give us two exhibits that were under our belts. And then Hurricane Katrina happened. It really pulled the rug out from under us, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. But I will say that we were the first new cultural attraction that opened post-Hurricane Katrina. And we opened in 2008.
Here in the space that we're in now?
No.
Or no, where was that?
That was at the Riverwalk.
Oh, at the Riverwalk.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that either. Okay.
So what happened was the Riverwalk, which had been this super popular and successful kind of tourist mall, mm-hmm. began to limp without tourists. And one of the major anchors had been The Limited. Now, The Limited, that shop, was having its own financial problems that had nothing to do with the hurricane. But under the lease, if you were closed a certain period of time, they could pull out. And so they did.
Okay.
And that left a big empty space that nobody was, because the demographics had changed so enormously, nobody was trying to get. Mm-hmm. So we took that space that had been The Limited. And one of the things that we wanted to do was we wanted to do our own marketing. Now, you know, in a mall, the reason you go to the mall is because the mall markets itself. It doesn't market you individually. It markets itself. And then you go and wander around the mall and you stop at this store or that store. We were promising that we were going to market ourselves because we needed to establish ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of why they were happy to have us, but also because we were an empty space, what was an empty space, we were going to fill it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would have one less empty space. And so it was a perfect location for us. It was at the end of the Riverwalk, the end by the convention center. So
okay,
the conventions began to rebook and started to come again, the first place you came as you entered the Riverwalk was to walk by us.
Right.
And we were also in the middle of the food court. And that's where we began this concept of allowing people to bring a drink into the museum. And so you could get a drink in the food court, unlike a lot of food courts I know.
Yep.
But certainly
it's
in New Orleans.
Right.
And so we learned that people enjoyed that. And so that was how we got started. And
we were there
for 5 years. We had a five-year lease. We were there for 5 years. We figured that would give us a time to get established and to find a more permanent location. And so that's how we came here.
Great. And so where we are now, friends, if you don't know, we're in Central City on Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard at the corner of OCH, as we call it, Aretha Castle Haley, and Martin Luther King.
That's right.
Boulevard. And this is a really cool space because obviously a lot, I'm guessing, quite a bit bigger.
It is definitely bigger.
And kitchen spaces and stuff
in
here as well.
All the lessons that we learned in that space that I call our incubator space.
Good one.
were put into actual fruition here. One of the things we learned was that we needed to be able to do real demonstrations in a kitchen. What we were doing at the Riverwalk is we had a table. We had burners on the table. There was no bathroom to speak of in the space because it was a relatively old mall from the 1980s. And so there was a gang bathroom. And we would
behind the space.
Well, it was shared.
Or the public one.
Yes. And it had like little hand sinks with those tiny little faucets.
Uh-huh.
And so you had to bring a glass with you to turn that on and then pour the glass into a pitcher to get enough water. And then we would take the dishes home every night to wash at home because you couldn't possibly wash them in the bathroom.
Sure.
And we realized we need a kitchen. And that was a big lesson.
That was a big lesson. It is a food museum.
we learned a lot there.
Well, let me ask you this, Liz. We got to take a break in about 4 minutes or so. But you mentioned that when you were starting the museum that people couldn't get their head around what the model is or was. You know, maybe describe that a little bit, because we know in New Orleans we like to, and in a lot of places, but it's very special here, we like to talk about food and drink, and you know, a lot of times, like, you wake up in the morning and the first thing out of your mouth is, what's for dinner tonight? You start talking about it. But what was the mission of the museum beyond, I mean, sharing food with people, but that's got to go much further than just that.
Well, we wanted to be a place that illustrated the intersection of food and drink and culture. That's really what we wanted to be. So that meant you had to give people something that was experiential, as well as not only historical, but cultural, so that you saw the cultural aspects of food, not just recipes or something like that. And that's what we always wanted, was that cultural component, and we wanted to embody that. But people thought we were going to just have, like, old food. You know, they just didn't get what we could be.
So here's just an antique can opener kind of thing? I got you. Okay.
And so that's why we had to have exhibits and have activity around what we were doing.
And we know, Liz, because I think that's such an important part of the museum and what you're talking about now. And I'll use the term foodways, which is kind of also a newer expression, like pop-up, I guess. You know, these are stories, right?
That's right.
I mean, what's on the plate obviously matters, but sort of what's on the plate and ends up in your belly is almost like the end of the story.
Oh, it is absolutely true. And if you think about food, you're thinking about growing it, you're thinking about catching it, you're thinking about foraging for it, you're thinking about all that. And then on the other end, you have waste to get rid of and all of that. So, I mean, there's definitely a continuum. But food is also about identity. Food is all about the way you serve it. Food also can be other things, so that you're taking that sugar and you're turning it into an Easter egg that, you know, becomes, or it's turning into a sugar skull or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there are all these things that you do with food, including making rum, say, with that same sugar.
Sugar, right?
So it has multiple aspects. And then you're talking about slaughterhouses, and what does that mean? How do you deal with that? You're learning about technology. Now there is a refrigerator that actually plugs in, and you're not just using ice.
Right.
You know, there are all these things that are part of food and food ways that we wanted to be able to discuss.
That's great. And we're getting at this too. It's about the people and the cultures themselves.
Absolutely.
You said culture, but the people and all the different cultural influences bringing their sensibilities, their experience, their traditions, their knowledge to the table. And then how all these things find their way, you know, sort of, I hate to use this expression again, but collectively on your plate or in your glass.
Oh, that's right. And then there's a collective memory of different things.
Right.
There are all kinds of aspects. And we know that food really is a part of people's identity, and you can't separate who they are from what they eat. And I didn't understand why there wasn't already a food museum, because if you go, or you used to go to a natural history museum, there would be all those dioramas, you know, dioramas at natural history museums, and there was always one of people searching for food, and they talk about how much time was spent searching for food and all of that. Okay, so you find artifacts. You have fish hooks and bone tools, and you've got flint tools and all these things that people use to skin things, cut things, shoot things, whatever, like arrow points and all of that. And then after agriculture, almost every historical museum now goes to study art, hierarchy, war, religion, all these things that happened post-agriculture, and they stop talking about eating.
which is really interesting. Let's do this. Let's take a little break here and hold that thought.
Okay.
We're going to bounce right back in. Friends, we're going to take a break here on the NOLA Drink Show. I'm chatting with Liz Williams, founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Friends, come on back.
The Mayhaw is the craft cocktail bar located in the historic St. Rock Market. Join us every day for happy hour from 4 to 7 p.m. and weekly specials like Tiki Tuesdays, Whiskey Wednesdays, and Thrifty Thursdays. The Mayhaw offers local craft brews and a robust and ethically sourced wine selection for enjoyment with your meal on the patio or for carryout. The Mayhaw is excited to present Mayhaw Mobile, a cocktail, beer, and wine delivery service. Learn more at strochmarket.com.
The green room is smoking and the flag is burning down. Throw my baby out the window and let those guns.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Yep, we are chatting with Liz Williams, the founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Sipping on a little wine, as we like to do, because, Liz, that's become a tradition. Whenever we do our show recordings together, there does need to be a little bit of alcohol in the glass.
There does. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Well, we were joking, too, because lots of times we have these very long sidebar conversations between segments, and then we lose ourselves in those conversations. But this time we came right back in, because you were talking about, like, natural history museums dropping, you know, so you start talking about war, maybe art, maybe whatever it is, but dropping the sort of agricultural story or the food story, it's also so integral, I mean, necessary in the story.
Well, I think that one of the reasons that happens is that agriculture became something that the serf, the peon, the lowest level of person did.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, it wasn't interesting. Art,
or a harder story to tell, too, right?
Oh,
because the information's
true.
Not there.
Not recorded.
Not recorded, yeah.
So it's easier to tell the story of art because you have these metal sculptures or you have clay sculptures or something that actually lasts. And so much of the tool that you might have had that might have been wooden or whatever, it just is destroyed, mm-hmm. ultimately, through use, or even if it wasn't destroyed through use, it decays ultimately.
Or just obsolescence, right?
That's
people move on to a new piece of technology.
Right, and they burn it, mm-hmm. they do whatever. And so you don't have all of those things. And so we have these gaps where we really don't know how people served things, what it looked like. You know, there's so much speculation. And so one of the reasons we wanted to start this museum was to preserve that, because that is actually cultural.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as though people stopped eating.
Right. Right. I need to sometimes, but I just continue. that's a huge part of this. And it is really interesting. And then I guess we see, you know what, maybe in the past 20 or 30 years, not so much from a museum standpoint, but from a anthropology standpoint. I mean, I remember actually an undergraduate taking a course that was on, it was a political science course, but it was actually on food. And this was in like 1990. And that was seen as very cutting edge from this particular professor. So it really hasn't, point simply being, it hasn't really been that long that we've been using food and drink as it ties into culture as a mechanism to tell the story.
That's right. It is a very new concept. And one of the things that has been very interesting for me is that there have been these kind of nerdy people out there, and I say that in the best possible way, who have made it their business to collect certain things that you or somebody else might think is really weird. And they've come out of the woodwork since we've opened and said, here, look at this. For example, let's say you're studying beer and you want to know what bottles were used for that beer to be bottled in.
Mm-hmm.
So we know about aluminum, we know about bottles that are there today, but there's been a whole change of how bottles have been capped, how bottles have been used. And if you look at old catalogs, you'll see line drawings where certain bottles were sold or whatever, 3 for a penny or whatever they were.
Mm-hmm.
But those line drawings were in pulp catalogs, which are full of acid and they're deteriorating. What better way to know what the bottle looked like than to have the bottle?
Right.
not a picture of the bottle. And most of those bottles were not pictured in art or something like that because they were so mundane.
Right, right, right.
And so having those bottles is actually important. And to know what that bottle looked like in 1910 and then how it changed in 1930 and how it changed again in 1950, all of those things are important.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there are people out there who have collected those things because they got interested in them. And they were thought to be nuts. And we're
you
so
were called
happy.
You were called a pack rat, and now and
right.
now you're a donor.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, so that gives us a little bit of a flavor, or a good bit of flavor, on what's going on at the museum. Because if you come into the museum, and I'll have you describe this in just a second, Liz, but so you will see like bottles, or you will see old kitchen tools in some cases. You will see, I mean, we'll talk about the library and stuff too, because there's a lot of research materials that we don't see on display. But we see these artifacts. But then what's connecting the dots here are things like what we were just talking about. It's telling the story of why these things matter.
That's right. And one of the things that we don't have right now because of COVID, but that we had before, was we had gadget tables where we had gadgets on display that you could pick up and play with.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could try to guess what they were, or you could say, oh, my grandmother had one of these or whatever. And people loved that. Now, you know, because other people touch them, you can't really
sure.
do the same thing. But it was a kind of interactive that isn't a technological interactive that people really, really liked. And it allowed you to see how those things change. But it also reminds you that this is such a throwaway culture that those very inexpensive tools often were just tossed if they broke or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So they've become rare because people throw them away.
Right.
And you get to see that evolution. I love that.
It's neat. You'll hear overhear people when those displays are happening. I used to always love somebody would come in. I'd overhear them saying, wow, I haven't seen one of these in X number of years. Or like, you know, my grandmother used to have one of these. I had forgotten about it entirely. Or then occasionally, like, you would see a gadget on the table. And you're like, what the hell's that?
Right. Right.
And how do you use it?
And I love some of the ones that really advance technology. Because if you go from a whisk, or maybe even a fork that you might have used to make, say, a meringue or egg whites or something. And then you get to use a crank mixer.
Right.
I mean, the amount of work you save and the time you save is really enormous. And that jump in technology is really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That why the technology is pretty simple. Why wasn't that done before?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that that's really fascinating. And you also know, for example, like with refrigeration, you know, before refrigeration and you had an ice box, you got your ice and that's the ice that you had is the ice that you bought, whether it was a block or whatever. Well, then once you had a refrigerator, you could make ice yourself
mm-hmm.
because there was that little compartment. And in the book that came with the refrigerator that tells you what you can do, it tells you how to make ice. And they didn't have facts then, FAQs,
mm-hmm.
but they did say questions that you might ask. And one of them was, how do you make ice? Do you have to boil the water first? What do you have to do in order to make the ice usable? But what you could do then with that refrigerator is you could make aspics. So you could take gelatin without needing to submerge your pot or your bowl in ice. You could just leave it in the refrigerator overnight. So aspics suddenly became something that weren't special that you only got at a restaurant, but that you could make at home,
mm-hmm.
which then segued into Jell-O.
Right.
So thinking that you probably had almost universal refrigeration by the end of the 30s, you've got 40s to develop not now just unflavored gelatin, but already gelatin fixed with sugar and flavoring, so that by the 50s, Jell-O becomes this ubiquitous thing. I mean, who thought that that's why you would have Jell-O?
That's amazing. And then probably, what were we at, maybe in the 60s when we started adding vodka?
Oh, yeah.
We'll have to look in that into a research project, Liz. Who and when did the Jell-O shot? Where did it all
where
come
did
from?
It start?
You know, I ask the hard-hitting questions on this show, really. Let's do this, Liz. Let's take another break here on the NOAA Drink Show. We're chatting friends with Liz Williams, the founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Come on back.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans.
Brought to you by the Saint Rock Market, a local food hall featuring 12 unique food and beverage entrepreneurs serving globally inspired meals from barbecue platters to Mediterranean cuisine. Located at 2381 St. Claude Avenue, the Saint Rock Market is open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, dinner, coffee, and cocktails. We offer online ordering, curbside pickup, and both indoor and patio dining. Learn more at saintrockmarket.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We're chatting with Liz Williams, the founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and this is coincidental because we're sitting in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum right here on Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. And Liz, we were talking about all, you know, interesting stuff as it relates to the culture of food, the history of food, and it all really does, and we mentioned this, but it all really does tie together here in the museum. So if you come visit the museum, all these really interesting things we were talking about, you can see and experience, see the gadget, but get the story.
Yes. I think, especially since COVID happened, we've spent a lot of time rethinking things. You know, it almost has given you a reset button to press. And so we've expanded our Louisiana gallery so that we're now in the old restaurant space. Mm-hmm. And so we have this bar from Brunig's Restaurant, which we're almost to the point of having our own liquor license, and we're really waiting for that. Mm-hmm. With bated breath. But
cocktail pop-up,
that's exactly right.
Sorry, go on.
That's right. But we have expanded the gumbo garden so that now it's all planted and it's really usable, and we have the complete kitchen, which is a temporary exhibit all about electrification and how it has changed the appliances of the kitchen and thus how we use our kitchens. And I think that's a really important and kind of elucidating thing. We are about 100 years from that time, because really it was in the 1920s that electrification really became something that people could aspire to. It took until the 1930s for it to be more universal, but mm-hmm. we're about 100 years away. And so really it's interesting to see what all those early appliances look like and how they changed the way we use our kitchens. Mm-hmm. And then we have, of course, our 15 states in the South and the District of Columbia, and everything has been revamped and upgraded. And so it's a really great time to come and visit the museum, because even if you've been here before, it's really new.
Yeah, you guys have done and really good work, as you and I want to make sure that people know this. You know, you guys took great care to make sure that the exhibits are the exhibits and tell the story they need to tell, but things are spread out. It's safe to be here.
That's right.
You guys are doing what you're supposed to be doing. You know, you have to wear a mask when you're in here, all that good stuff. So it's still a great opportunity to come and wander around and just sort of give yourself that self-guided tour.
And it's big enough and there's volume enough that you don't feel close in or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So people, I think, feel safe when mm-hmm. they're here.
That
so
absolutely.
That's a good thing.
Now, and real quickly, too, and you're going to stick around for the podcast only segment, another shot with NOAA Drink, so we're going to talk more. But as we close out, we've got 6 or so minutes left, Liz, before we close out the radio portion. Under the roof here, if you will, of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum is also the Museum of the American Cocktail.
That's correct.
And an absinthe display as well.
That's right. So in 2014, we took over the Museum of the American Cocktail. So even though it had existed in the Riverwalk, when we closed the Riverwalk, it moved to Las Vegas for a short time, where it sat in Commander's Palace, restaurant in Las Vegas. And then they closed. I think there was a transfer of ownership of the underlying casino or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And so when we opened here, they opened with us, but this time they made it ours.
Okay.
And so we tell the story of the development of the cocktail, and that's a whole lot of fun. But what we also did was expand so that every exhibit, every state exhibit, includes the beer, the wine, and the spirits of that state. Mm-hmm. So that you not only see it all together as a cocktail exhibit, but you see it incorporated into every state. And that was a way for us to make it more integrated. And then because New Orleans was the absinthe drinking capital of America.
Absolutely.
Because of our ties with France and speaking French way until the 20th century as the home language of so many of us. Because it was popular in France, it was popular here.
Mm-hmm.
And we have really, I think, the largest display of absinthe artifacts in the United States.
Yeah, it's a really neat exhibit. You're 100% correct. The far and away the largest consumption of absinthe was in the United States was in New Orleans.
That's
and I
right.
think you can even make a case at the end of the 19th century it might have been the largest absinthe consumption in the world, possibly. Maybe Paris, but I think
Paris was the rival.
Yeah, there was some conversation, though. It's interesting. I've done a couple shows on absinthe, and there's some conversation about volume and who is consuming what and where it came from and some things like that were pretty interesting. But it's an important part of the story here as well.
It absolutely is. We found an ad for an absinthe house opening in New York, and in the ad it said, "We drink absinthe here in New York at the New York Absinthe House the way they do in New Orleans."
Right. Because you have no cred if you try and tell it other way.
That's right.
So Liz, with the museum, so how long has the museum actually been in this space here in Central
City? Since 2014.
In 2014. Okay, great. So what are the hours and when can people come and visit?
So our COVID hours are from Thursday through Monday. So we're closed Tuesday and Wednesday, and we're open from 11 to 5. So we're open, a nice chunk of the day, but Tuesdays and Wednesdays we're closed.
Do you need to make a reservation to come, or do you guys kind of like if people let you know they're coming, right?
So you can buy your ticket online, and it can be a time ticket, but we haven't wound up having enough of a volume of visitors that has been a problem.
Okay.
So if somebody just at the spur of the moment wants to come, they can.
Okay. And what about, let's talk about some of the programming too, because we've talked about the museum and the exhibits. Got about 3 minutes left here, Liz. Tell us about some of the programming that you do, we can couch it in COVID a little bit, but just in normal times. We got demo kitchens and all kinds of stuff.
So we do have a demonstration kitchen, and during normal times, we had 3 classes a week that you could take during the day that wound up teaching you something about the food of New Orleans or the food of Cajun country, and also was lunch. And that has had to be curtailed. But we still have had wonderful classes at night that have been socially distanced and all that sort of thing, which have been very successful. We're looking forward to returning to a time when we can have those classes on a regular basis.
Right. And with the courtyard you mentioned in the back, the gumbo garden, that's going to open up some nice opportunities in the near future because we can obviously do more outside. And
that's right.
Weather is permitting here in New
that's
Orleans.
That's right. It permits for a good part of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fun thing about that space is you can set up a bar out there. It operates at night. We have fans so that, it's really pretty comfortable almost all year round.
Great. What about online, too? Because there's great e-newsletter. Of course, our podcast network.
The podcast network is number one. But we have a great e-newsletter. We have children's classes, both here in person and online. You can find Jenny Merrill on Facebook Live once a week doing some children's classes. And We also have a YouTube page where we have a lot of things posted. So we have lots of stuff going on.
You do. And before we close out the radio portion of the show here, Liz, in just a second, I would be remiss if I also didn't mention that there's a cool little gift shop area. So we're talking about cooking. Also, there's good, really cool cocktail books over there, really good cookbooks over there, and then a lot of really good history books and even musical history books over there. So
yes.
Good representation.
It's a great place to come if you need a hostess gift for no reason. You don't even have to visit the museum. It's a great shop, regardless of whether it's in a museum or not. And we also have a terrific library. And that library is open by appointment right now.
Great. We'll talk about that during the podcast only soon, because I want to get into some of the stuff that the museum offers that you don't see when you come to the museum,
okay.
Because it's an important part of the story. But friends, if you are, Liz, tell people the street address. Did you say it already?
So the address is 1504 O.C. Haley Boulevard, at the corner of Martin Luther King and O.C. Haley.
Awesome. Southernfood.org, friends, is the website. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Liz, because I've been dealing with this a lot lately, most social media channels, it's Eat, Drink, So Fab.
That's right.
I now have committed that to memory. Friends, if you are listening on the radio, I encourage you to go to the website, go to noladrinks.com and get the podcast, or go to southernfood.org and click on the tab in the media. Look for the Nitty Grits Podcast Network, because you'll find this show there as well. Liz is going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks. But again, if you are listening on the radio, friends, remember, be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time, cheers, y'all. Everybody, up another shot with Nola Drinks. Hey, thanks for sticking around, friends. Happy to have you here on this installment of the Nola Drinks Show and another shot with Nola Drinks. As always, going to bounce right back over to the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and continue our conversation with Liz Williams. Here we go. All right, everybody, up another shot with Nola Drinks. Thanks for listening in, friends. Happy to have you here. As always a pleasure and always a joy to be here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. As I was joking, Liz, towards when we first started the interview, it's like my home away from home now, because I've, outside of my home since COVID started, I've spent more time, I would argue, probably at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum other than the grocery store. And this is a lot more fun than the grocery store. This is a complete tangent, but especially when I was thinking back just the other day when COVID first started, which of course seems like a lifetime ago, man, it was so stressful to go to the grocery store. It was
frightening.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And now, of course, you throw on your mask and you just kind of do what you have to do. And I think it's not because it's any less dangerous. It's simply we've just all been inured to it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we know a little more about the virus because it was, you know, I don't know anybody anymore that comes home and like washes the plastic bags that your produce is in before you put it in the fridge and all that kind of stuff. But I joke with my wife, Sylvia, sometimes because, you know, one of the fun times occasionally you'd stumble into the grocery store on a Saturday and they've got, you know, they're doing a wine or beer or spirits tasting. You got 10 tables set up and you could, as I like to say, booze your way across the grocery store.
Right.
And we can't do that anymore. And it's like, you know, it was already kind of not fun. And now it's really not fun.
Right. No, it's that part is totally true. Yeah.
How do you think, since we were talking about this before, I guess that's a small slice of things. Obviously, we know in the world today what it's done to restaurants and hospitality has been absolutely devastating with bars. all these places, as we're talking about really the theme of the show, these things are so integral to our culture, not only here in New Orleans, but for everybody, how we eat and how we drink. This is, the landscape has been changed permanently, I think. Mm-hmm. But do you have some thoughts on it? I mean, how do you think?
I do. I mean, I think that as people are eating at home more and cooking at home more, of course, grocery stores have been the beneficiaries of all
sure.
of this.
Yep.
I think that it has gone on long enough that it will permanently change the way people eat, and that you're not going to be as likely to just pick up food on the way home that you used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that it makes you think twice about the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And things that maybe would have been things that you would never have attempted at home, you have now attempted at home.
Right.
And you've said, oh, I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I know that now I make mayonnaise regularly.
Oh, really?
I stopped buying mayonnaise at the grocery store because I started to say, well, do we need all the chemicals that are in mayonnaise to stabilize it? No.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to make it at home. So I don't make a quart at a time the way I might buy a quart at
mm-hmm.
a time.
Mm-hmm.
But I make it and we use it up and then I make some more. And it's those little things. I'll probably never go back to buying mayonnaise.
Right.
Because right. it's so easy to make. And I wouldn't have attempted it if I weren't cooking more at home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that for a lot of people also, they've seen how much cheaper it is to cook at home. And so you know how much it costs to make this. And it costs 3 or 4 times that to buy it at a grocery, at a restaurant, even pick up. And so you're thinking, am I going to buy this at the restaurant and not sit there and get served? And, you know, you can understand if you're getting served, you're eating off of china, you're not washing the dishes, you know, all of that. All right, maybe it's worth a lot. But right now, it's the same price when I get it as takeout as it would be if I bought it in the restaurant and ate it there.
Right.
And so why should I do that
mm-hmm.
if I can make it at home for a quarter of the cost?
Right.
And because you're now bringing it home, putting it on a plate, you still have to wash the dishes. You still have to do all of that. So why do it? So I think that, yes. Do I think that we'll go back to restaurants? Of course we will.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to buy takeout? Sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that we're going to just immediately rush out and go back to the way it used to be. There are things I think we will do that to. I think we'll go to theaters again.
Music.
I think
yeah.
we'll go listen to music. We'll go to the movies. We'll do things like that. But I don't think that, I think it's changed the way most people think about restaurants. Now, if it had only lasted 3 months, because, you know, they say that when there's a downturn in the economy, people eat at home again
mm-hmm.
to save money.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as the downturn takes its, you know, the edge off.
Kicks back up.
Yeah, then people go back to their old habits. But that's like 90 days or something.
Mm-hmm.
This has been way too long. It's over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be hard, I think, for people to go back. And your food budget and all of that has changed so much. Plus, you've bought the equipment to make it. You've done all kinds of other investing over the course of this period of time. So I think it's going to be very different.
I do too. I think, you know, and you touched on something that I think about with this. I think we know, and I'll just use New Orleans as a landscape for this because it's where we are, but I think this speaks, you know, true in many, many places. We, you know, I always knew and we'd have conversations that, like, you know, you go out, especially here, you go out, yeah, the food's wonderful. Yeah, the service is good. Yeah, the cocktails are good. Yeah, the wine list is good, whatever. But you can, like you just said, Liz, you can maybe, if you know, with some time and effort and some things like that, you could probably get yourself 80% there, right?
Mm-hmm.
A real chef and a real, you know, cocktail professional is going to make something better than you can at home almost across the board. But, you know, you can get pretty close. we go out because we want the experience, like you said, and we want the camaraderie. And that happens where you're sitting shoulder to shoulder with people at a bar and you learn things. That's, you know, we know information is exchanged in bars in New Orleans like nowhere else on the planet.
Right.
So I think kind of where my feeling about it is that I'm going to be more selective, meaning I'm not going to take it for granted as much. I'm not just going to go do this just because I can. It's going to be like, you know, I'm going to go because I want to be able to suck in everything that makes it different than what I can do from home.
Uh-huh.
But the frequency, I don't think, is going to be there for all the reasons that you just laid out.
Mm-hmm. And we've just had too much time to establish our own expertise.
Yeah.
That if we hadn't, we'd go right back.
Right.
But I think it's been long enough to change things.
Sure. Hey, we were just talking about this, too. We were talking about kitchen appliances during one of the breaks. And if you kind of think about it, it's like you can get yourself a cool whatever it is. We're talking about a sous vide in particular. Well, if you think about what a decent sous vide costs, that's dinner for two and a bottle of wine.
Right.
And that's one meal, which, hey, and it's the experience. I'm not denying mm-hmm. that. It's really important, and I love it. So don't get me wrong. I'm not poo-pooing it at all. But you kind of think about, well, you know, how many ribeyes I've now made in my sous vide and what that cost is. And it's fun. You know, I mean, we're also probably different than a lot of people is because we enjoy doing these things in our home.
Right.
Whereas a lot of people, you see these ads on TV for the food companies that, like, you know, ship you the stuff in a box.
Right.
And their whole thing is, you know, gourmet food, but you can avoid the cooking. And I'm thinking, that's no fun.
Right.
But I guess that markets to some segment because the people are buying it.
Well, my son, who lives in New York, he and I were talking about this, and he ate virtually every meal out.
Right.
And maybe breakfast, you know, he had orange juice in the refrigerator kind of thing. But I asked him, are you going to eat every meal out again? And he said, no. And even he's not going to. And he did. Every meal was taken at a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Because in New York, of course, they had home delivery long before they did here. And he could order whatever online, and it would just get delivered. And he said, "We're gonna cook."
Yeah, and I think that's gonna stick with a lot of people mm-hmm. because of that value proposition and weighing. To me, it's got to be driven so much more by the experience because the actual what's on the plate and in the glass is not so mysterious.
That's right. Yeah, I agree.
So Liz, let's with the museum here, obviously the museum, and we've touched on this a little bit in the interview, but the museum obviously has made some significant adjustments to COVID times. I mean, it was closed for a good chunk of time
mm-hmm.
and then opened back up in the way you guys spread out the exhibits and these sorts of things. But that's also, that's affected the programming. And I think some of the conversations that you guys are having as an institution
mm-hmm.
Moving forward. And I think, you know, trying to find some of these silver linings maybe in the pandemic situation, a lot of cool things that you guys are going to be doing and are doing to, you know, how should I say, alter or tweak the mission or the trajectory of the museum itself.
Well, besides the fact that we're going to continue doing things online in a way that we might not have if we hadn't had this thing happen, we're also expanding our library so that now our goal is really to be one of the premier culinary and hospitality libraries in the country. And people are so generous. We're getting donations from all over the country where people are saying, I'm going to downsize my library or whatever. And they're sending us fabulous books cool. in multiple languages and all of that. So that I think we're on our way. And we do have this partnership with the New Orleans Public Library so that our catalog is online. And we've had people fly in from different places to use our library because we have books that you can't get anywhere else.
Right.
So that's one thing. Another thing is the National Culinary Heritage Register. So this register is a place where you can register your thing, whether it's your restaurant, your grocery, your farm, your shipping vehicle, whatever it is, that is related to food in some way. I mean, you could be a waste disposal firm or you can be a brewery or whatever. And we are identifying the places that are 50 years old or older all around the country that have contributed to the food of America. and not just Southern, but the whole country. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that we found, is that we can serve the whole country online in a way that we couldn't if you had to physically be here. So not only are we making the museum available to all those people who can't come, we're trying to be involved in the cuisine of America, not just the South.
That's a really important point. And I think it relates to, too, I want to share the Facebook group that we have for the podcast network, because it kind of relates. That's what we're trying to, we had a lot of meetings, and I'll spare listeners the long story, but we had a lot of meetings to do the relaunch of the podcast network in recent months and weeks.
Right.
And the term that I kept resonating with me, and I kept going around, is community, 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 but not just in a small physical space, a broader community. So like what you were just describing, the Facebook group for the Nitty Grits Network is another example of that.
That's right. That's right. And it's a place where we get to talk about all the podcasts and all the people who are part of it.
Mm-hmm. Like you and me.
That's right.
Well, let's talk about real quick before we go here and close out the podcast segment of the show. So you do a really cool podcast called Tip of the Tongue. Will you tell people about that?
So Tip of the Tongue is really my attempt to talk about the intersection of food and drink and culture. So we talk about things to everybody. One thing that is coming up has to do with a Jewish heritage and how people may be involved with Jewish food, traditional foods, as their way of showing that they're Jewish, and not mm-hmm. necessarily something that they are doing in a synagogue, but
right.
just as a way of adopting Jewish culture. I love that. So we're having that conversation.
That's great. You have really cool guests, and it's a very, your show's usually about a half an hour or 40 minutes,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And we always tell people, because you and I have this chat from time to time, because the tagline on this show is exploring the world of drink and food, drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. But the cool thing is that, we have some intersections between how we do our shows.
That's
but
right.
these shows are different.
That's
and
right.
different guests, or even sometimes they're the same guests. You ask good questions. I just sit here and act like a buffoon. And so whatever you want to get out of the show, but just joking. But, there's a different flavor to the different shows on the network.
That's right.
And some are, some of the new ones that are coming on are going to be quite different. But there's going to be that connection there. And how everybody goes about doing their business on their show is a bit different. So there's a lot of variety there, I guess is my point.
And that's really what we're looking for, to show that you can look through different prisms at the same material mm-hmm. and get something different out of it.
Yeah, it's great. So, friends, go check out the Nitty Grits Podcast Network. Go to southernfood.org, and it is there. Liz, will you tell people one more time the hours and the address and all that for visiting the museum?
So the address is 1504 O.C. Haley Boulevard here in New Orleans. We're open Thursdays through Mondays from 11 to 5.
Perfect. And friends, again, go visit southernfood.org. Look right there at the top. You'll see a media tab. Click on that. You'll see the Nitty Grits Podcast Network and all the other cool stuff. You can explore some of the exhibits here and see what the museum's all about. Be on the lookout for all the really cool events that we're going to start seeing more and more of. And hopefully sooner than later, we're going to be back to the full-blown course of kitchen demos and all the other cool, tasty stuff that goes on here.
That's what we're looking for.
That's what we're looking for. Liz, thank you so much
for taking some time.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks.
Always a pleasure to chat with Liz, friends. I will be back after this brief musical interlude to close things out. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show this time around, friends. Happy to have had you here. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Liz Williams from the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. As you know, this show is part of the Nitty Grits Podcast Network. We talked about that on the program. And you can just go to southernfood.org, which is the museum's website, and look for blog and podcast right there at the top on the navigation bar, and you will find a link to the podcast network. And as we talked about, we've taped a bunch of shows there and had people on from the museum before and so on and so forth. But first time we really got to take a deeper dive into the history of the museum and its programming, its mission, and so on and so forth. So that was really a lot of fun and a very interesting journey around and through the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And, I'll add, of course, as we probably know and imagine, but maybe all of us haven't thought about actually, certainly another set of businesses or institutions, organizations that have been hit hard by COVID are, of course, museums. Obviously, very tough to visit museums in these times
And they've really suffered from it, the Southern Food and Beverage Museums in general, but the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in particular. And I wanted to know that they've done a very good job since they've been allowed to reopen. They spread exhibits out. They removed a lot of things. One of the cool things about the museum that I hope we'll get back to soon is it was very hands-on with certain things. But because of COVID, they had to remove a lot of things that you got to, you know, quote-unquote, play with in the museum. I hope we get that back. But they've been really, really very responsible in how they've managed the museum across the board to retool the footprint of everything going on in the space to make it COVID safe. So I would encourage you to go visit. And now, as we're all getting our vaccines, go get vaccinated, people, of course. But, you know, we'll be seeing more events at the museum and things will hopefully be returning to normal. Another thing that we touched on, of course, but I also think they've done a great job with is it caused them to reevaluate a little bit of who they are. Yes, it's a physical space. There are exhibits. There are, you know, were programs in person, and it's a research library, but they kind of retooled things and started to really work to build a community where the museum itself is the center, but you don't necessarily need to be there physically to connect. And I think that's a really important thing. The Nitty Grits Podcast Network that we've been talking about is really an effort related to that and an important part of that. So we're very proud to be connected to the Nitty Grits Podcast Network and continue to push forward the mission of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Go check them out, southernfood.org. If you are listening to this program before Saturday, March 27th, I would encourage you to mark your calendars. There's going to be a really cool event coming up. It's actually called the Central City Makers Market. Excuse me, the museum is located in Central City. Central City Makers Market. And it's going to be a really cool event. It's going to be taking place on the patio that they redid in the back of the space. And there's going to be food vendors. There's going to be a pop-up bar, social distancing, all that good stuff's going to be in place. And hopefully it'll be a nice sunny day. So go check it out. You can RSVP on the Facebook page and you can find out information there. They are at Eat Drink SoFab on Facebook. And of course, more information at southernfood.org. We'll be out there hanging out for that event. And I hope to see you out there. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.